You can turn to Leviticus, to the last chapter, just to give you a little heads up of where we're heading next. In the month of July, we will be looking at the book of Joel. And in the month of August, we'll look at Zephaniah. And the reason I picked those two minor prophets is because they both have three chapters. And we have 3 weeks in each month because we'll continue with our spiritual family nights. Next month will be a special family night put on by our teen group. So I'm not sure exactly what that will be involved, but I'm looking forward to it on the last month of July. So that's what we'll be doing to close out the summer, looking at a couple minor prophets each of the months. And then beginning in September, we will launch into a study through the book of Ezekiel. So just know where we're at on Sunday evenings. But tonight we're finishing Leviticus. And if you've been with us through the duration, you know that Leviticus, the easiest way I see to think of the book of Leviticus is to think of it as a procedure manual with a bunch of different tabs dividing it, because that's really the way it lays out. There's some flow to the sequence, but in general, it's different topics, different tabs to pull out to see how do we handle various aspects. The whole theme of the book of Leviticus is how should the nation live as a holy nation. God had called Israel to be a unique people. They were to be distinct from all the nations around them. They were to be holy and separate. What did that mean? Well, the first tab, the first section, was the sacrificial system. God gave them the sacrifices that were their guidelines for how they could deal with their sin issues and what needed to be done to maintain that holy status. And the whole sacrificial system then culminated with it being inaugurated, with the priesthood being initiated and the beginning sacrifices being made. That culminated in that glorious record we had of God living among his people. He was dwelling in their midst. He came and dwelt within the tabernacle in the midst of the congregation. Well, the next section from there was the cleanliness code. And that was really a section for the priest specifically. The priest had to determine what was holy and what was not. What would be clean items and what would not be clean. All dealt with that in that holiness code, that the priest could make the proper determination along the aspect of what would be unclean, what would be clean, and what then could be elevated to holy status, fit for worship. The Day of Atonement came at the end of that, which provided a means for the holy nation to remain holy, to keep their holy status. It provided the means for a holy God to live among his holy covenant people. That was followed by the largest section, the Holiness Code, that was there for the people in general. This was their instructions for how they should live as God's holy people in a covenant relationship with him. And it concluded, as we saw last week, with that section of God's covenant commitment to blessings and cursings. Here's what he promised he would do if they were consistent with the obligations of the covenant. And here's what God promised he would do if they failed to obey the covenant. Well, now we're coming to a very final chapter, a last section that there really is one final tab, a very short tab at the end, that deals with a topic of vows. Vows and dedications that are made to the Lord that go beyond the normal sacrificial offerings. There were a number of offerings that were described in the first seven chapters that the people were to bring. Those were obligatory offerings for different situations. They had to bring, if they had committed a sin, they had to bring an offering. If they wanted to express special thanksgiving, there was an offering for that. There were special offerings to give, but in addition, above and beyond that, they could make vows and dedications. And that's what the final chapter deals with. Making the vows was a very personal decision. It was an expression of a willing devotion to God. It was not required. But as we'll see as we look through it, once made, the vow had to be kept. There, in some cases here, we'll see substitutions could be made to the vow, but most frequently, substitutions in the form of money for the value of the offering, plus add an additional fifth. If you want to substitute money for the vow, that was allowed in most cases. But the vow itself had to be kept. These vows, when we look at the history of Israel, they provided a significant part of the funding for the sanctuary. So the placement of this material at the very end here may have served to reinforce the importance for the nation of funding the central object of their worship, the tabernacle itself. All the instructions are laid out to keep the tabernacle in operation as far as the process goes, but funding is a reality. There needed to be a funding for it, and the vows came to play that role. They provided a large augment of the funding. So we're just going to work our way through this chapter, and then when we get to the end, we'll see how it applies to us, what applications we can make. It really splits into some logical sections, different types of vows. The first section in the first 8 verses deals with vows that dedicate an individual to the Lord. So let's read verses 1-8. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is of the male, from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. If it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even up to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. If they are from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if he is poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means of the one who vowed. The priest shall value him." So these are vows dealing with individuals, the dedication of an individual. In fact, we'll see this in operation after way out. This is probably beyond your planning horizon, but once we finish our study of Mark on Sunday mornings, then we're going to have a month where we're celebrating the Reformation. So coming up in November, Lord willing, we'll launch into the book of 1 Samuel. And 1 Samuel begins with one of these vows of an individual. Hannah promises, she makes a vow, if God would give her a son, she would dedicate him to the Lord. And we have the baby Samuel. So we'll see that in operation when we get that. But that's what this section is talking about, the dedication of an individual. And that individual is worth a certain amount of value. And that value that we see listed here represents either the wage of a worker or the relative worth of the value of the person's services to the tabernacle. This person is dedicated to the Lord, so they're dedicated to provide their service to God. So what is that service worth? How do you put a monetary value around that? One of the commentators suggests that looking at extra-biblical sources, that means other records we have from that era of the nations around them, that the amount here of 50 shekels was fairly comparable to the standard market price for slaves. It's essentially how much work could the person achieve. And it's all given in shekels, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 grams of silver. And the person should be valued. And it's all based on what their amount of labor would bring. How much could that person provide? So that way the person did not have to spend their entire life. If they're dedicated to the Lord, the person would not have to spend the rest of their life serving. They could be purchased. That money could be given in place of the individual. As in other passages in Leviticus, there are exceptions made for the poor. If the person had been vowed and then is found out that the person's too poor to make good on their payment, then the priest had the opportunity to adjust the amount, because God always wanted even those that were poorest in the nation to have an opportunity to worship him. So just as they could bring a dove for a sacrifice instead of a lamb, here the valuation of the person could be reduced. Now, the only example I can think of off the top of my head is Samuel, where we see this actually fully in operation, and Samuel was never purchased back. So we don't know exactly how frequent this was that they would make these kind of vows, but you can imagine how it goes. God, if you will help me in whatever crisis I'm in, I will commit myself to you. Well, that would be the type of vow. And then once the person got back on their feet, rather than continue serving in the temple, they could purchase themselves back, or purchase a family member. So that's the idea of the first dedication here. We have dedications of individuals. I'm going to move fairly quickly because otherwise we'll just get bored with the material and I don't want you to fall asleep tonight. So we'll move on because you get the general idea here. The difference of worths is based on the age of the person and how much physical labor that person is able to perform. The core of life for a male set the highest value and everything seems to be ranked around that when they were at core working ages and then younger and older, and females were able to bring less labor, so it all adjusts accordingly. Well, verses 9 through 13 deal with the dedication of animals to the Lord. Instead of promising a person, you could promise to the Lord an animal. Look at verse 9. Now, if it is an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering to the Lord, any such that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. He shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad, or a bad for a good. Or if he does exchange animal for animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. If, however, it is any unclean animal of the kind which men do not present as offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest. The priest shall value it as either good or bad, as you the priest value it, so it shall be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, then he shall add one-fifth of it to your valuation. So animals could be vowed. Animals are candidates for these vows, and that's what we see here. That animal, once it's vowed, is to be holy. Remember, holy means set apart. It's dedicated. It's set apart to service at the temple. It's interesting that brings up the holy animal could not be exchanged for another animal. Human nature is so prevalent to try and find, there's got to be some angle. So when a person is desperate, they value, I will give my best lamb. And then the crisis is over, well, I'll just give a lamb. And God says, uh-uh. If you try to substitute, then both animals become dedicated. And notice for an animal that can be offered as a sacrifice, there was no redemption possible. The animal had to be donated. The difference, or the difference option comes if it's unclean animal. In this case, unclean means it's an animal that is unable to be offered as sacrifice. Is disqualified from sacrifices. Think of like a donkey. Donkeys were not sacrificial animals, but we know they used them. Samuel, again, he rode a donkey. They used beasts of burdens and various things. So they could dedicate that type of animal, in which case that animal could be redeemed. The priest would place a value upon it, and that value plus 20% would be the purchase price to redeem that animal back, if the person wanted to redeem it. Otherwise, it remained the possession of the priesthood. Well, that takes care of the first two types. Moving on, we have a third type of object that can be dedicated, and that's non-living objects. And there's a couple different styles here, but verses 14 through 25 deal with non-living things that can be dedicated to the Lord. Now, if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. Yet if the one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add one-fifth of your valuation price to it so that it may be his. Excuse me. Again, if a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. If the one who consecrates it should ever wish to redeem the field, then he shall add one-fifth of your valuation price to it, so that it may pass to him. Yet if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts in the Jubilee, the field shall be holy to the Lord, like a field set apart. It shall be for the priest as his property. Or if he consecrates to the Lord a field which he has bought, which is not part of the field of his own property, then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of your valuation up to the year of Jubilee, and he shall on that day give your valuation as holy to the Lord. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to the one from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs. So this section is dealing with non-living things, and basically you have two types. There are lifted houses and fields, but the fields take a couple different options as well. So they could dedicate houses that belong to them, they could dedicate a portion of their family land, or they could dedicate a field that was not part of their family land, a field that they came to possess through a purchase. And remember, those purchases were temporary. They were like leases up till that year of Jubilee. So if it's a house that's been dedicated, that could be repurchased by its owner if the owner paid the full valuation of the house plus, again, 20%. So if a person dedicated their house to the Lord, it went to the priesthood. If their possession, the person could buy it back at the valuation of the house plus 20%. If it's land, land is a little more complicated. How do you put a price tag on land? Well, the Lord gives them a process here. The value of land is assessed by how much seed is required to plant that land. And it's based on a homer. And he sets one homer of seed is worth 50 shekels of silver. So if whatever land is dedicated would take one homer to seed, then it's worth 50 shekels. If it would take two homers, it would be worth 100 shekels, and so forth. He uses the amount of seed as the foundation to determine the price of the land within a valuation of a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels. But you have to factor in the year of Jubilee. Remember, every 50 years, the land reverts back to its original ownership. So that comes into price. So basically, it works out to one shekel per year up to the year of Jubilee. So if the dedication occurs on the year of Jubilee, you have 50 years till the next one, it's 50 shekels. And based on that, however close you are to the year of Jubilee, you reduce the price at rate of one shekel per year to figure out how much this land is worth. So once the land is valued, then the redemption follows like everything else. If you want to redeem the land that's been dedicated to the Lord, pay that current valuation and 20%. If the owner had not redeemed the field by the next Jubilee, then it becomes the Lord's property. In other words, it passes permanently to the possession of the priesthood. So the person could dedicate their field to the Lord, it would go to the priest, and he had until the next Jubilee to pay it back, to purchase it back. If he did not do that, then it became permanently the Lord's. Or if he sold the land, that would be a little almost dishonest. He's dedicated land to God, but he's still in trouble, so he sells land to a neighbor. Remember, a sell only goes to the year of Jubilee. So he sells the land to a neighbor. He gets the price, the money from that, but it's not enough to buy the land back. He uses that to live on. Well, at the Jubilee, the land should revert to him from the person he sold it to. The person he sold it to only was really leasing that number of crops till the year of Jubilee. What comes back to him, he hasn't purchased it back from the priesthood, so it goes straight to the priesthood. You can't dedicate it and then sell it. It was the point. The other restriction that's put on here, if the owner buys land from someone, and then he dedicates that land, so someone else is in a bind, they sell you their land. Again, remember, you've only really leased the land till the next Jubilee. You haven't bought the title outright. The land always is the family's land. So you buy it, and then you say, well, I've got this land over here. It's not really mine, but I need to dedicate something to the Lord. I want to make a vow. I'm going to use that land. Well, that land at the year of Jubilee goes back to its original owner. You can't dedicate the land of someone else and retain it permanently. So that land always goes back. God arranges it so that land will go back to its rightful owner unless that owner forfeits his ownership by dedicating it to the Lord through a vow without redeeming it. Hopefully that makes some sense. So that's the whole idea. When you work your way through, that's what that all is about. How do you value the land, and then how does the year of Jubilee fit in when it comes to letting land go back to its ownership if it has not been redeemed? Now we get into what I think is the more interesting part. We have some qualifications that are placed upon the vows. A much shorter section, but these are some qualifications that God gives in verses 26 through 29. However, Notice that's a qualification. However, here's an exception. A firstborn among animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may consecrate it, whether ox or sheep. It is the Lord's. But if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it according to your valuation and add to it a fifth shekel of it, or a fifth of it, and it shall not be redeemed. Then it shall be sold according to your valuation. Nevertheless, anything that a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has of man or animal or of the fields of his own property shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. No one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Here's some qualifications, exception conditions. The first one in verses 26 and 27 deal with the firstborn. Firstborn animals were not candidates for dedication vows. Firstborn animals were God's already. The Lord claimed all the firstborns. So they were already dedicated to him by the fact that they were the firstborn. That was God's requirement. And it's rooted in the Passover event. Remember, we're not far from the Passover event. This is the generation that is the Passover generation. They were taken out of Egypt at the Passover. Now they've gone through the Red Sea. They're at the Mount Sinai. They received the law. This is that generation. Rooted in that, the fact that God passed over them, we have the dedication of the firstborn. In Exodus chapter 13, verse 2, God says, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. It belongs to me." So the firstborn child and the firstborn animal already belong to God. So that's why he's saying here, firstborn among the animals, you cannot dedicate as a special vow to me. They're already mine. Now, in Numbers, we have some clarifications about what that means for the firstborn. Numbers 3, verse 13, God says, "For all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel, from man to beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord." In Numbers 8, verses 17 and 18, he says, "For every firstborn among the sons of Israel is mine, among the men and among the animals. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified them for myself. But I have taken the Levites instead of every firstborn among the sons of Israel." So there's the exception for the Levites. The Levites were set apart for God because God replaced the firstborn of all the sons of Israel with the tribe of Levi. And that's why the Levites were dedicated to serve him. So that's the point behind verse 26, why the firstborns among the animals cannot be consecrated, because they're already God's. Then verse 27 just qualifies if the firstborn happens to be an unclean animal, then the worshiper could redeem that animal at its value plus 20%. Unclean animals were not to be offered as sacrifices, but they were useful. So they were useful in that they were worth a value. So they could be sold by the priesthood to people. Clean animals that were fit for sacrifice, again, could not be redeemed, but unclean animals, things like donkeys, the firstborn went to the priest. The priest could sell that to the nation. There's money to the priesthood. So it's an economic system. Where it gets really interesting is in verse 28. "Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart." This is a different word for set apart. It's actually the same word we had at the end of the verse where it says, "anything devoted." This is the word that I alluded to this morning, the source for the word korban that we saw in Mark. The Hebrew word that word is based on, anything that man had devoted is an exception, because it becomes the Lord's possession permanently. That term devoted, as we have translated here in English in the New American Standard, is used to delineate something or someone that is a permanent, definitive offering to God. It's not a dedicated offering that can be purchased back. It is a permanent possession. So you can see that the Pharisees and the scribes that we saw this morning in Mark, they were looking here. "Nevertheless, anything that man sets apart, anything that he calls korban, permanently devoted to God, cannot be sold. It cannot be used." That's what God says in his law here. So they were using that as a loophole. I'm going to set things apart. I'm going to dedicate things. I'm going to devote it to God. So it cannot be sold because it says, shall not be sold, cannot be redeemed. It's permanently God's. But what are you going to do with it? Well, I'm going to keep using it as long as I'm alive, but it's God's. That was the way that the Pharisees were using it. That's not the way God intended it. But God did have this category. Things could be permanently devoted to him. Devoting something to God meant dedicating that item to the service of God or subjecting it to utter destruction. Most often, this term is translated throughout the Old Testament as under the ban. Something is placed under the ban. Here in verse 28, we have it translated at the end of the verse, anything devoted to destruction. But it's the idea of placed under the ban. If you were with us when we journeyed our way through Joshua, we saw this a few times in Joshua. If they moved into the land, God said, for example, Jericho is to be devoted to me. It was placed under the ban. That means everything was dedicated to destruction. Man and beast were to be destroyed. Everything was to be destroyed. Ai was to be placed under the ban. It was devoted to God. It was this permanent dedication to God. And remember, Achan's issue was he took something that was devoted to God and hid it instead of destroying it. So anything that's devoted in this fashion either is permanent service to God or subject to utter devotion or utter destruction. There's no other option. You cannot purchase it back. It cannot be redeemed. It is permanently God's. Those who qualify as devoted to death are those who were captured in battle, as we saw, like in Jericho, you see examples in Numbers. Or God uses the same term for anyone who commits murder. If someone commits murder, if they take the life of another human in murder, they were devoted to the ban. They were placed under the ban. They were devoted to utter destruction. There was no redemption. Capital punishment was the requirement. So it has an idea of absolutely fully dedicated to God. And that's why the Pharisees then picked that up, and or scribes rather, and they came up with loopholes, and were using that for intent God never intended it for. God used it as a qualification, a specific type of vow that could be made where something was made to him absolutely, given him completely. Or in some cases, God required it to be given him completely. The chapter closes out with kind of a different topic altogether. We come to the topic of the tithe. A tithe is, in essence, a dedication to God, but it's not as voluntary as the rest of these, but it's dealing with money throughout here, so that's probably where the tithe comes in, economics. God writes, or says here, thus all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the land, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add to it one-fifth of it. For every tenth part of herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. Or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. So these turn to the tithe. Tithe pertains to everything from the land. Now, this would not be the first time Israelites had heard about tithing. The practice of tithing was observed long before the giving of the law. We have example of Abraham with Melchizedek all the way back in Genesis 14, where Abraham gave a tenth of his victory spoils to the king Melchizedek in Genesis 14. In Genesis 28, when Jacob is leaving the land, he promised God, he's fleeing from Esau, he's leaving the promised land, and he promises God, If you allow me to return, I will give you a tenth of everything I have. So two of their forefathers, their earliest patriarchs, had tithed. It's not a new idea of tithing, but God's putting parameters around how the tithe is to operate for them. And this text specifically addresses the general tithes. There were three different types of tithes in Israel. We have the general tithe that applied to everything in the land. There's the tithe of the sacred meal. When they brought a praise offering to a peace offering, that's the word we're looking for, when they brought their peace offering, a tenth of that went to the priest, or when they brought their grain offering, a tenth of that, their sacred meal. And Then there was a tithe that was paid every 3 years to the poor. So there were three different tithes. This is the general tithe that applied to everything in the land, everything that was grown, everything that was born. And the tithe item could be repurchased, again, based on the value of the object, plus 20%. They owed to God 10%, save their barley harvest. But maybe they needed that barley harvest for seed next year. They had a great wheat harvest. They didn't have so much barley. So they needed the barley. So they could sell their wheat, get money, and buy back their barley tithe if they needed to keep it. That type of a scenario where they could buy back their tithed item at the valuation plus 20%. But unless that was done, it was the Lord's. Well, either way, it was his. It just could be repurchased. And same for the animals. The animals were tithed, and the process was simply by counting every tenth animal that passed under the shepherd's rod. And God makes a point. Again, you can't set a line up here. You can't line your sheep up so that every tenth one happens to be the bad sheep. And you pass them under. It's just whatever they come in at random, that's the tenth one. And if you start trying to substitute a good for a bad, well, then they're both mine, and you can no longer repurchase. So they have that obligation to let God have his. And the book ends with one final verse. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. So just simply sums up that all of these statutes, everything we've seen in this book, have been given Israel because they're in this covenant relationship with God. He is Yahweh, he is their Lord, and they were given to them through Moses from their covenant God. And this chapter specifically points out that holiness, though, is more than a matter of divine call. It's not simply the fact that they were called to be holy by God, and it's even more than correct ritual. It's not just that they do all the right things. It requires a total consecration of their life to God. And that means that sometimes they should willingly serve God and dedicate beyond the minimal obligations. So what things can we take away from this chapter? I think there's a few different things that we can take away. We, again, live under the New Testament. We're not under this covenant relationship. But God is still the same God. So the expectations that God has in general for how his people interact with him, the way they respond to him as a holy God, hasn't changed. One thing I think we can observe in this chapter is God doesn't really lay out when the people would make these vows. It seems as if almost he assumes that there is a human tendency to make vows when desperate. When we get into desperate situations, humans are going to turn to God. And we know that as reality. I mean, I keep thinking back to 9/11 when we saw all of our government officials standing on the Capitol steps offering prayers. They don't really know God, but when a crisis came, they were looking to God. God doesn't indicate disapproval of such actions. He actually seems to lay out an expectation that this is how humans will respond. In fact, we know from the rest of Scripture that sometimes God will bring hardships into lives simply so people will turn to him. But I think what we can take away from this is that there's a tendency to make vows when desperate, but God is not a mechanical God. We cannot negotiate with him. That's one of the things that you could see the Israelites might have been trying to do here, why he put some of these prescriptions. You can't exchange your animals. You can't negotiate with me. You can't say, well, get me out of this and I'll give you something, but I'll negotiate when it's not quite so desperate. So there's some give and take, God. When I'm in bad straits, then I'll lean one way, but yeah, well, I'm not so bad. I've got more leverage. No, we can't negotiate with God. He's not a mechanical God. There's no negotiating with him, and simply vowing doesn't guarantee anything will change. That's obvious from the fact that people could make a vow, they could dedicate their land, and fail to be able to repurchase it. Giving a vow to God did not mean that they were magically going to have their situation turned around so that in 3 years down the road they'd be in good shape and could buy their land back. That might have been their desire, but God leaves options here where if that does not happen, here's what you need to do. There's no mechanicalness to God. He is sovereign, and he will do things for his reasoning and according to his will that we may not fully comprehend. But what we can recognize through these vows is that mankind is able to offer genuine signs of repentance and humility through vows. If it's a true heart of humility, because a person has gotten themselves into desperate straits because of sin, a vow to God is a method by which they can repent of that and show God the depth of their repentance and the humility that they're coming before him. So God seems to leave vows out there as just, this is a reality of how you'll have to interact with me at times, the way you'll want to interact with me. But what we also should understand is surrounding these vows, there's a clear expectation from God. God takes vows made to him as absolutely binding. This is not a negotiation. This is a commitment. And because God, in the previous chapter, spelled out how he handles his commitments, here's what I will do for blessings, here's what I will do for cursings. There's no negotiation. It's a simple matter of fact. If you obey, I'll do this. If you disobey, I'll do that. Well, following right on the heels of that, we have this set of vows, and we should take from it that God expects us to be just as faithful to our vows as he is to his. His covenant was a vow to his people. So that should cause all people of God to avoid making rash vows. We don't think a whole lot of vows. We're probably not as familiar with vows as we ought to be, but we do have one vow that is quite common still in our culture, and it's the wedding vow. It's a vow that's taken before God. It's taken before God until death do us part. God, we tell before God as he is the witness. That means that our wedding vow is absolutely binding in God's eyes. May not be so in our eyes, but it is in God's eyes. And one thing I think we can take away from the seriousness of the vows we see here is how absolutely binding in God's eyes he would take even our wedding vow, so we dare not break it in a frivolous manner. We live in a country that says, yeah, if it doesn't work out, move on. God hasn't changed. Vows made to him are still serious matters. We also can see, I think, in this chapter of God's view of hiding behind false piety. Especially when you combine it in God's providence that we had this morning with the whole topic of Corban, and we see here this idea, God doesn't take lightly someone who makes a vow and then doesn't quite uphold all the aspects of it. But this morning highlighted even the idea of hiding behind a vow, a heart that is against really humbly being before God. Trying to use a vow to pretend to be pious, but really being self-centered. God knows the heart. He knows the heart by which a vow is taken. We cannot hide behind false piety. At the end of the chapter here, we deal with the tithe. Well, as New Testament believers, we do not live under the tithe. The tithe was an Old Testament principle. It was the way God structured his economy. We don't live under that. You don't find in the New Testament any instructions about tithing. But we can think about, what was the goal of tithing? What was it to teach the nation of Israel? The goal of tithing, when you step back and think about what was God doing with it, he used the tithe to teach Israel that everything we have belongs to God. It starts as his, and then he allowed them to keep part of it for their own use. But he enforced that everything was his because he got the firstborn of everything. He got the first part of the crops. He got the first of everything. Everything belongs to him. Well, that goal should inform us that again, God hasn't changed. Everything we have belongs to him. So while we're in the New Testament, not under tithe, nothing's changed. That everything we possess belongs to God. Now, in the New Testament, instead of tithing, what we find is the idea of a free will offering and the idea of generosity. So I think it's incumbent upon us as New Testament believers to ask ourselves, what would free will giving and generosity look like? Because we live on the other side of the cross, we understand much greater degree than the Israelites understood the depths of God's grace and the depths of his mercy, all that he's provided. What does free will giving and generosity look like? And it would just seem that the tithe would probably be a reasonable minimum guideline. That's what God established as a mandatory amount. So if it was mandatory, it probably isn't really generous. generous is probably above mandatory. So I would think at the very least we could look at that and say the tithe, while we don't live under, is probably a reasonable minimum guideline for us to start with when we figure out what would be reasonable to give to God. He expected the nation of Israel to give him 10% as representative that they understood that everything was his. Should we do less? Something to ask ourselves and consider. Well, that's all I had prepared tonight. Any questions from this last chapter? Wasn't a real long chapter, but it definitely stands on its own as a separate component. Donna.
That didn't stem from a scriptural thing it is, or a scriptural principle.
Yeah. Well, you asked about the pledge that churches would do. I know of a lot of churches doing that. In one sense, a pledge could be like a vow. You know, it could be a form of a vow that you make to God. But practically, I think by and large, churches were using it to help with budgeting purposes. How much should we anticipate receiving? How do we know unless we ask? And if we ask, then we can set a budget. I think it was more pragmatic. But I do believe because you make a pledge in that standpoint saying, I will give to God this amount, God would tend to see it as a vow. We've committed ourselves at that point to doing something. We've promised. And any sort of vow before God is something that he takes very serious. So I think you could look at it from that standpoint as the equivalent of a vow. Any other questions? Russ. Yeah, it's not human sacrifice, but it's specifically dealing in verse 29 with the cases like those. Let me pull up my notes here where it's listed. In Numbers 31 and in Numbers 35, there's qualifications of those who are devoted to death. God uses the same word, and it's the case of those who are captured in battle. When they go against the Canaanites, God expects the Canaanites to be destroyed. So he uses this word, they are devoted, they are, lack of a better word, Corban. They are dedicated God, they cannot be redeemed. Remember Saul's great sin was that he failed to kill the king, what was the king's name? Now I'm drawing a blank. Huh? Agag, yes, Agag. Why? How could I not think of that? Agag. Failed to kill King Agag, even though God had told him to. He was to be destroyed. He was to be committed to destruction. So it's not human sacrifice, but it's the case where God says there's certain individuals that they cannot be redeemed. I have determined that they are to die. The other example where this is used is those who commit murder. God enforces capital punishment in Numbers 35, and he uses the same word and says they are dedicated to death because they've committed murder. There's no redemption for them. So, good question, though. That's where I'm a little unhappy, actually, with the New American Standard that translates it set apart and then devoted. It loses the fact that he's using a very specific word, different from holy, that also means consecrated, set apart. He's using a very technical term that signifies something different. And when it's brought in English just kind of loosely as set apart, we can't keep track of that uniqueness. Ben? Oh, interacting with church covenants. That's probably another, I can anticipate where you're going. Church covenant is another form of a vow that we make. We commit ourselves to God, that we are going to be united with this group of people for a specific purpose. We have a church covenant that spells out that commitment that we're making. It's a vow. It's a vow before God, and therefore we should take it serious like God takes a vow serious. Because we're saying before God that we are going to do these things, and you can look at our covenant and it spells out what the things are that we've committed ourselves to doing. But so often we kind of take that pretty softly. We don't look at covenants as being that binding. Well, this whole book deals with a covenant relationship that God had with the nation of Israel, and it was absolutely binding on them. So we probably need to be much more careful about our covenant relationships with each other and take those much more seriously, because everything we see in Scripture is that God takes them seriously. And if God takes something seriously, we ought to take it seriously. I think we start out saying that at the beginning of the book when we hit something. If God takes this serious, we should. It was when we were talking about worship. If God takes worship serious, we ought to take worship serious. Well, if God takes covenant serious, we ought to take covenant serious. We are to be responding to God's mind on things. I assume that's what you were implying. Anything else? All right, well, that brings us to the end of our study through Leviticus. I'll have Pastor Ben and Jerry come and lead us in a song and close us in prayer this evening.